Last 3 weeks or so, I've been working on this sermon, and it's grown and grown and grown and gotten bigger and bigger. And it's not really a sermon, it's really a study. I'm going to be going fast because I have a lot of slides. I have like 65 slides here, so I'm going to have to, I have to get less than 1 minute per slide, try to make it in, 45 minutes, but it'll probably be more than that. But I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited about it, this sermon. I've been looking forward to sharing this. Book of Mormon Archaeology in the United States. And we have on the AVA website, we have a web page about Book of Mormon Archaeology, and specifically there, most of the stuff on there is with regards to Central America. There are a couple things with regards to the United States, but I've been doing some reading and I've been watching some videos in preparation for the sermon. And you got to ask yourself the question, how much of the Book of Mormon story took place in the United States, in this land specifically that we live in, and how much of it took place in Central America? It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter where it took place. We have faith that it did take place, and we believe our Book of Mormon. We know that it's true, and that's what's most important. But I think it's worthwhile to consider some of these things and to think about them, and they're very, very interesting. And in Central America, we have a lot of evidences of possibility of some of the things taking place down there in Book of Mormon. There's temples down there. There's sunken cities, inscriptions. There's murals and paintings of white natives. There's legends, there's stories, etc. And we also find a lot of those things here in the United States as well. So that's specifically what I wanted to talk about, was the United States. And our brother Adam, he's done a sermon or two recently in a study about some of the evidences, a really good study that he did. But I specifically wanted to talk about the United States today. And, how much of it, perhaps it took place not only in Central America, but a good portion of it up here in this land as well, in the United States. And we don't know for sure where it took place. And we read about it in the Book of Mormon, how there were those, I think his name was Haggith, and he was a shipbuilder, and he built ships, and many of the Nephites would get onto these boats and they would depart to the land northward, and they would never hear from again. They didn't know what happened to them. Sometimes they assumed that they would die in the sea, but they didn't really know. There were some that departed into the land southward. And then when it came down to the very end, all the Nephites were destroyed except for those that united with the Lamanites. But we don't know what happened to all of them. It's a possibility that, they did migrate northward, and even maybe migrated southward into South America even, eventually. We don't know for sure. And in the Book of Mormon, we know of three different people groups. We know of Lehi's family, we know of the Jaredites, and who we call the Molokites. Those three different people groups. But again, it's the gospel of Jesus Christ is what matters and what's important. But even so, like I said, it's interesting to consider these things. And it's neat. And then to me, it's enjoyable to really think about these things. I think it would be neat to be an archaeologist and go around and to study some of these things. I don't think I'd have the patience for digging things up, very carefully. But to be an explorer, in a kind of way, that just really, really seems really neat to me. The first verse I have is from 1 Nephi 3, 176 to 177. With regards to this choice land, it says, "Nevertheless, thou beholdest that the Gentiles which have gone forth out of captivity and have been lifted up by the power of God above all other nations upon the face of the land, which is choice above all other lands, which is the land which the Lord God hath coveted with thy father, that his seed should have for the land of their inheritance." So it's talking about a land here, and it's the land of the Gentiles, and it's also the land that has been coveted with Lehi's seed. Lehi seed, you know, would be the Nephites and the Lamanites. So when I read this verse, to me, it's the same land that we're living in as the Gentiles is the same land that was given to Lehi's seed for an inheritance, this land that we are living in. And, you know, I guess you could think about it and say, well, yeah, it was the land of Lehi's seed, but it wasn't during Book of Mormon times. You know, the Lamanites maybe didn't migrate to the United States until after the Book of Mormon story, and that's possible. But to me, this verse kind of tells me that it's the same land, the land that they lived in and the land that we live in, which is the United States, us as Gentiles, it's the same land. So I want you to think about that and just consider that. This continent, there was a statement that the angel Moroni said to Joseph Smith. He said there was a book deposited, written upon gold plates, giving an account of the former inhabitants of this continent and the source from whence they sprang. And we don't know how much of this is Joseph Smith's language. I tend to favor, you know, I would hope that he would quote Moroni directly when he said this, but it says the former inhabitants of this continent, you know, the North American continent, not just Central America, the whole continent, the former inhabitants of this continent. So think about that. Book of Mormon people groups, let's talk a little bit more about these. The Jaredites were around from about 2200 BC to 130 BC, and I didn't come up with those dates on my own, of course. They came right from our Book of Mormon. That's where I got these dates. There was the Nephites, 600 BC to 420 AD. Again, dates out of our Book of Mormon. The Lamanites, 600 BC, and I said to present because we believe they're still around. So, you know, when we go through this archaeological evidence in the United States, let's remember these dates, you know, kind of keep these dates in the back of your head and see if any of these dates line up with the Native Americans that lived here and the dates that the archaeologists think they were around. And the Mulekites left Jerusalem about 585 BC. This is the first Native American culture I wanted to talk about, the Adena culture. They lived in Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, Kentucky, New York, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. And I got that from the Ohio History Central website. There's a wide range of dates given as to when they were around. And if you look at these dates, you can see that they vary by quite a bit. I mean, they start at 1500 BC is one person's interpretation or dates given to this to when they were around. 1500 BC to 300 AD, that's Wayne May. And he's a member of the LDS Church, and he's a proponent of the Book of Mormon story having taken place up here in the United States. And I don't even think he believes it took place at all in Central America. But he's an amateur archaeologist, is what I was calling him. He publishes the Ancient American magazine. And it's a really good magazine. Wikipedia, they had 1000 BC to 200 BC. Ohio History Central had 800 BC to 1 AD. And the Britannica had 500 BC to 100 AD. So you can see just at the start date, there's a 1,000-year variation. Not so much at the end. We've got 200 BC up to, I guess, 300 AD. So there's 500 years. So they don't really know for sure. And they use radiocarbon dating. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a scientist. So I don't really understand it all. But the thing is, they don't know for sure. So take these dates with a grain of salt. Another Native, no, I think it's picking it up through the, I think it's a radio station or something. Is that better, the left side? still there. Yeah, I think we're just gonna have to put up with it. Still okay. The next culture is the Hopewell culture. They flourished along the rivers in northeastern and midwestern United States, along the rivers. Again, there's a wide range of dates given. 600 BC to 200 AD was the Ohio Encyclopedia. 500 BC to 300 AD was the state of Michigan, on one of their websites. And the 400 BC to 400 AD Britannica, 300 BC to 400 AD Wayne May, 200 BC to 400 AD Ohio History, 200 BC to 500 AD Wikipedia. So again, another wide range of dates. We don't know for sure. But what's interesting, if you look at these dates, the ending dates, we know that the Nephites were destroyed. For the most part, 420 AD, that date that we previously talked about, and these dates kind of end about that same time. So I don't know, is that coincidence, or some of these Hopewell people, who they call the Hopewell, were maybe they some of the Nephites, and it's a possibility that they were. I've got some different maps that I found. This is the first map. Early North American farmers east of the Mississippi River are known as Eastern Woodland and later as Mississippian peoples. This was from Britannica.com. And the blue squares are the Edina sites, the green ones are the Hopewell sites, and the red ones are the Mississippian sites. And again, this varies. If you go to different websites, this map changes. It's never the same. I did have a quote here with regards to the Hopewell culture on the previous slide. It said, around 500 CE, that's 500 AD, the Hopewell exchange ceased, mound building stopped, and art forms were no longer produced. War is a possible cause as villages dated to the late woodland period shifted to larger communities. They built defensive fortifications of palisade walls and ditches. Conclusive reasons for the evident dispersal of the people have not yet been determined. Much more knowledge is needed. And that's according to Wikipedia. So when I read that, to me that sounds like the Nephites. But we don't know. I thought that was a good quote. So again, back to the maps. I've got this map. Here's another map. This is different from another website. It shows a Hopewell interaction sphere and everywhere that they were located in the United States. I mean, and the name Hopewell, it really doesn't mean anything. I think it's the last name of a man who they named some of the sites after, I believe is what I read. It's just a name. Here's another map that I have here. It says Berber American Civilizations, 1000 BC to 400 AD. And then they've got down here the dot at the bottom, 1,500 BC for that people group. They got the Edina, the horizontal lines in the upper right, 500 to 100 BC, and then the upper left, the Hopewell, the vertical lines, 100 BC to 480. So again, it's another range of dates. I thought this poverty point, I had never heard of this poverty point culture before. But I wanted to talk about them for a little bit. Poverty Point culture inhabited the area of the lower Mississippi Valley across the Gulf of Mexico from the Olmecs. And some people think that the Olmecs are the Jaredites in the Book of Mormon. So they were across the Gulf of Mexico. Wide range of dates given, 2200 to 700 BC Wikipedia. That one really interests me because at 2200 date, lines right up with what we have in our Book of Mormon for the Jaredites. 2000 to 600 BC, Louisiana State. 1800 to 500 BC, University of California. 800 to 300 BC, New York Times. So in the Book of Mormon, it talks about how the Jaredites were in the land northward, in the desolate land. So if you go back to this map, this really wouldn't make sense if you'd have the Nephites and the Lamanites up here on the top and the Jaredites down here at the bottom. But, you know, did the Jaredites, did they migrate northward maybe? You know, and then they were in the land northward? I don't know. And I came across an article, and the title of the article was, Did the Olmec Civilization Originate in Louisiana? So now, some of the scholars and archaeologists are thinking, they arrived here first in Louisiana, and then they went across the Gulf and became the Olmec culture. So I thought that was very interesting. Here's another map that shows North America, Mesoamerica, South America, and it shows where the Olmecs lived. In the red, Olmec core area, and then the pink area, they say the Olmec culture influenced before 2,000 years ago. And I've got an article, a story, it's from Archaeological News Network, and I wanted to read it. It says, around 1600 BC, an ethnic group began constructing large villages on raised semicircular earthen platforms along tributaries of the lower Mississippi River. Within these platform villages, they also built ceremonial mounds. A mound built at the Poverty Point, Louisiana village site is one of the largest ever constructed in the United States. The platform villages were long abandoned when the French arrived in the region in the late 1600s AD, so the identity of native ethnic groups who occupied them is not known. Around 1600 BC, a new culture appeared on the Gulf Coast of the Mexican state of Veracruz. It introduced the construction of pyramidal mounds and the technology for making pottery to Mexico. By 1500 BC, the Zoque were building large villages and cultivating plants indigenous to Mexico, in addition to the cultivated plants that are typical of the Caribbean basin. And the Zoque, that's another name for the Olmecs. By 1200 BC, the Zoque were building cities with large pyramids and numerous public structures. The Zoque towns and ceremonial centers were abandoned around 600 BC. This is also the same time period that the platform village at Poverty Point, Louisiana, was abandoned. So, you know, maybe it was the same people. Surviving history of the Zoque preserved in stone indicates that the Zoque claimed to have arrived on the coast of Mexico from a homeland across the Gulf of Mexico in three giant flotillas of seagoing canoes. The Yuchi Indians of the southeastern United States also have a tradition that they paddle to North America from the home of the sun in the east. So that matches right up with the story we find in the Book of Mormon. And Wikipedia says, the origin of the Yuchi has long been a mystery. The Yuchi language does not closely resemble any other Native American language. So the Yuchi, I guess, are another people group. It says that we're in the southeastern United States. Yeah, southeastern United States, and they have this belief that they came from people that crossed the ocean. I wanted to talk a little bit about defensive forts, Alma 21, 149 to 150. And now it came to pass in the 11th month of the 19th year, on the 10th day of the month, the armies of the Lamanites were seen approaching towards the land of Ammonihah. And behold, the city had been built, and Moroni had stationed an army by the borders of the city, and they had cast up dirt round about to shield them from the arrows and the stones of the Lamanites. For behold, they fought with stones and with arrows. So they built this fortified location, and they heaped up the dirt round about, cast it up, made a wall out of the dirt. Here's another one, Alma 22, 1 through 3. And now it came to pass that Moroni did not stop making preparations for war or to defend themselves against the Lamanites, for he caused that his army should commence in the commencement of the 20th year of the reign of Judges, that they should commence in digging up heaps of earth round about all the cities. Again, digging up this dirt making walls with it, throughout all the land which was possessed by the Nephites. And upon the top of these ridges of earth, he caused that there should be timbers, yea, works of timbers built, up to the height of a man round about the cities. And he caused that upon those works of timbers, there should be a frame of pickets built upon the timbers round about, and they were strong and high, and he caused towers to be erected that overlooked those works of pickets. So they had, you know, a fence on the top of these ridges of earth that they dug up, and towers. One more, Alma 24:54-55. And Teancum, by the orders of Moroni, caused that they should commence laboring and digging a ditch round about the land or the city Bountiful. And he caused that they should build a breastwork of timbers upon the inner bank of the ditch, and they cast up dirt out of the ditch against the breastwork of timbers. So, reason why I brought this up is because I wanted to talk about some of the earthworks and the mounds that they found in the United States. This one here, this is Mound State Park. This is only, it's only like an hour and a half south of where I live. I guess I went there when I was a kid camping. I didn't remember it. But you can see they've got a ditch. They got this big wall here. And these trees, you can't really tell from this picture how big these trees are, but I've seen pictures of, I should have put one in here, pictures of people standing up next to these trees. And they look really, really small. These trees are really big. So this is quite, you know, a significant bank of earth that's been built up. Here's another one. Again, these trees are really, really big. Mound State Park. I've got a quote from Wikipedia. It says, Mound State Park is a state park in Anderson, Indiana, featuring Native American heritage and 10 ceremonial mounds built by the prehistoric Adena culture, indigenous peoples of eastern North America, and also used centuries later by Hopewell culture inhabitants. The Great Mound is a circular earth enclosure with an internal ditch and south to southwest entrance. The term earthworks includes any structure made from the earth. In Native American studies, there are three primary types: mounds, circular enclosures, and complexes. All are found in central Indiana and in the state park. Mound State Park has a complex of enclosures, both circular and rectangular. There are 7 enclosures and 4 additional earthworks, which have been divided into 2 groups, the northern complex and the southern complex. The Great Mound enclosure and the dominant structure in the park and the southern group. And there's also places like this in Central America. There's a city called Beckin that has a moat built around it, and they found evidences of posts, like it talks about here in the Book of Mormon. But, you know, I think it's interesting. You wonder, to me, this was a city of some sort, you know, a city, a quote city. It seems like it was built as some sort of fortification, you know, fortification. Why would they do this? Dig a ditch around it, heap up the earth like this? Whoever lived here, you know, was a very, you know, was a big civilization, and they had the manpower to do this. And they didn't. Yeah, it's hard to see the size.
It looks like kind of like a burial mound in the picture.
Yeah.
And then
it's not. It's
just huge.
This one might be a big circle. And they didn't have, you know, in this area, they didn't have a lot of stone to work with. So this was really the only option that they had. They took the earth and they dug it up rather than, you know, using stone, because they just didn't have it. Here's another one. There's a lot of earthworks in Ohio. This one's in Newark, Ohio. We should all make a trip down there sometime, or up there. Defensive forts. I've got 2 more slides about this. Alma 21:152-153. But behold, how great was their disappointment! For behold, the Nephites had dug up a ridge of earth round about them, which was so high that the Lamanites could not cast their stones and arrows at them, that they might take effect. Neither could they come upon them, save it was by their place of entrance. So there's, you know, one place of entrance that they could get to them through. Now at this time, the chief captains of the Lamanites were astonished exceedingly because of the wisdom of the Nephites in preparing their places of security. Alma 21, 170, 171. Now behold, the Lamanites could not get into their forts of security by any other way save by the entrance, because of the highness of the bank which had been thrown up and the depth of the ditch which had been dug round about, save it were by the entrance. And thus were the Nephites prepared to destroy all such as should attempt to climb up to enter the fort by any other way, by casting over stones and arrows at them. They did some surveys in the 1800s. There's two people, Ephraim George Squire and Edwin Hamilton Davis. They wrote a big book and did surveys of these locations, and this is one of them. This is called Fortified Hill in Ohio. And if you look up there along the top, my laser pointer is broken, so I was not able to use it, but if you look up there at the top, that's the entrance. There's one entrance in. I think these others are towers, and you see what they did? They build up the earth, and then they built these little ridges, so it's like a maze trying to get through this thing to get in. So this would give a great advantage to the people who were defending this. You know, they could just sit maybe along one of these ridges in the back, and they could only squeeze in a couple people at a time, and they could just pick them off as they came in through this little gap. And this is what it says in Wikipedia. It says, the site was surveyed in 1847 by Ephraim George Squire and Edwin Hamilton Davis. The works would be documented in their 1848 book, Ancient Monuments of the Mississippi Valley. They noted that the ditch around the earthworks was on the outside instead of the inside of the wall. The top part of the earthwork is described as enclosing a small circle, 100 feet in diameter, with two small mounds inside of it. A third mound, which has been truncated, was just north of the small circle. Both the small mounds had altars found in them after excavation. Ash and sherd were found in the altars. The two men believed it was a fort of defense, with the altars providing spiritual assistance. This, and here's another one. This is from scienceviews.com. It says, this fine work is situated in Butler County, Ohio, on the west side of the Great Miami River, 3 miles below the town of Hamilton. The plan is from a survey by James McBride, and the description is made up from his notes. The hill, the summit of which it occupies, is about a half a mile distance from the present bed of the river and is not far from 250 feet high, being considerably more elevated than any other in the vicinity. So that's pretty big, pretty tall. It's surrounded at all points except a narrow space at the north by deep ravines presenting steep and almost inaccessible declivities. The descent towards the north is gradual, and from that direction the hill is easy of access. So it wasn't too hard to get in from the north, but really it was really difficult to get in from, I guess, the west and the east and the south side. So it's 250 feet high. In the vicinity of this work are a number of others occupying the valley. No less than 6 of large size occur within a distance of 6 miles down the river. So this is just one of them. There's a bunch of them scattered around this river. The character of the structure is too obvious to admit of doubt. The position which it occupies is naturally strong, and no mean degree of skill is employed in its artificial defenses. Every avenue is strongly guarded. The principal approach, the only point easy of access or capable of successful assault, is rendered doubly secure. A mound, used perhaps as an alarm post, is placed at about 1/4 of the distance down the ascent. A crescent wall crosses the isthmus, leaving but narrow passages between its ends and the steeps on either hand. I guess it's talking about some of these ones at the bottom left. In the event of an attack, even though both of these defenses were carried, there still remains a series of walls so complicated as inevitably to distract and bewilder the assailants, thus giving a marked advantage to the defenders. So they're talking about along the north side here. This advantage may have been greater than we, in our ignorance of the military system of the ancient people, can understand. But from the manifest judgment with which their defense positions were chosen, as well as from the character of their entrenchments, so far as we comprehend them, it is safe to conclude that all parts of this work were the best calculated to secure the objects proposed by the builders under the modes of attack and defense then practiced. Here's another one. This is Fort Hill in Ohio. And you know, if you think about the Book of Mormon story, you know, happened, you know, 1,600 years ago when the Nephites were destroyed. And consider these mounds, you know, trees would grow up. It's been 1,600 years, and it's difficult finding these places. You know, a lot of it was destroyed by farmers and the migrants that came here from Europe. You know, when we came to this land, a lot of these things were just destroyed. But they are still finding them here and there in some places. So again, this is Fort Hill. Ark of Appalachia Preserve System. This is what they wrote. They said, the major earthwork at Fort Hill is an ancient earthen-walled enclosure constructed on top of a large flat-top ridge. The earthen stone wall has a circumference over 1.5 miles. So you could get a lot of people in one of these. Its span interrupted with that 36 definite man-made openings and 3 more possible man-made openings. And I think Wayne May thinks that these were towers. The wall itself ranges from 6 to 15 feet in height, averages 30 feet wide at the base, and encloses 35.3 acres. I don't think I'm going to read all of this. Archaeological evidence suggests that the earthwork was built approximately 2,000 years ago by people belonging to what is often referred to as the Hopewell culture, an epithet derived from the surname of the European owner of an early excavation site in Ohio. What name these Native Americans called themselves and in what language they spoke has unfortunately been lost to the mists of time. The Hopewell culture is associated with nearly a dozen mysterious hilltop enclosures in southern Ohio. Got another one. This is Fort Ancient in Ohio. You can see that the man standing there. See how big that ridge is, or how steep that bank is. From Wikipedia, Fort Ancient is a collection of Native American earthworks located in Washington Township, Warren County, Ohio, along the eastern shore of the Little Miami River, about 7 miles southwest of Lebanon on State Road 350. It says it's a prehistoric hilltop enclosure built by the Hopewell peoples who lived in the area from the 1st century BC to the 6th century AD. You know, that's part of the Book of Mormon time frame. It says the Fort Ancient earthworks were built in 3 stages over an estimated 400-year period. Archaeologists estimate the total volume of earth in the walls is at 553,000 cubic yards. The site was visited and surveyed in by John Locke in 1843 and Edwin Hamilton Davis and Ephraim George Squire's Ancient Monuments of the Mississippi Valley. They describe Fort Ancient as one of the most extensive, if not the most extensive, work in the entire West regarding its size. So it's pretty big. So that was defensive forts. I want to talk about temples now. 2 Nephi 4:22-25, and I, Nephi, did build a temple, and I did construct it after the manner of the temple of Solomon, save it were not built of so many precious things, for they were not to be found upon the land, wherefore it could not be built like unto Solomon's temple. But the manner of the construction was like unto the temple of Solomon, and the workmanship thereof was exceeding fine. They had found temple mounds. I don't know how many of them are left, but they, you know, had found quite a few. I don't know if some of these have been destroyed since this time. Here's one on the left, the Temple Mound, Marietta, Ohio. And it's a plateau, a raised plateau. I can't read that number. 188 feet, but I think that'd probably be way too high. But if you look at it, it has ramps going up into it, not stairs, but ramps, which we're going to talk about that. And there's another one on the right side, kind of looks like a pyramid, with this plateau at the very top. Archaeology and American Encyclopedia, this is what it says. It says, the diverse shapes seen in the elements of the earthworks have led to the attribution of the use of the site to different prehistoric cultures dating from 500 BC to the late pre-Columbian times. The tall conical mound has been assumed to be an Adena design and the earliest element. The geometric nature of the two nearly squared enclosures had led to a hopeful assignment. Many archaeologists and laymen considered the raised platform mounds to be an example of temple mounds. So they believe that they built something on these plateaus. I mean, they did something important up here. They wouldn't have made this raised, you know, earth plateau like this with these ramps going up to it. And if you read in the Bible, Exodus 20, 25 to 26, the Israelites were commanded not to use steps up to the temple, so their nakedness would not be exposed. And when I was reading, I didn't include any of the information, but it sounds like, yeah, back in Old Testament times, they, you know, well, of course they didn't use steps, it says they're in the Bible, but, you know, the Jews agree with that point, that they didn't do that. They used ramps. And, you know, and back here, I don't know if they really had a lot of stone to work with, but these are ramps going up to these sites. Here's another one. Temple Mount situated above the Ohio River near Cincinnati. There's a ramp here going up into it. This is from a book called The Mound Builders, Archaeology of Butler County, 1904. It says, fragments of burnt limestone may still be seen on the top. The mound is rectangular, 225 feet long and 120 feet broad and 7 feet high. In contrast to the hewn stone builders and altars of Mexico, the Ohio mound has the right dimensions to have an accompaniment, a timber and burnt lime plaster cement building of the size and proportions of Solomon's temple. So I couldn't pass that quote up, and I put it in here. This J.P. McLean, who wrote this quote, he didn't have any association with the Book of Mormon at all, and he said this. He was actually, says he was an American Universalist minister, an archaeologist, and a historian. Here's some more temple mounds. I got the zoomed in view on the right. Temple Mound in Ross County, Ohio. There's the river there on the left. It's an elevated square, it says, with the ramps going into it. Here's another one. Temple mounds enclosed in a circle. Two of them. With some other little mounds used for something. And then we got the one on the right, which is a diamond. I don't remember if this was a ditch or if it was a ridge, but you know, why do you guys think they would do this, put a ditch around it or a wall around it? Yep, yeah, keep others away. Maybe for privacy, you know, make it poor. Only certain people maybe were let in this place. This one, temple mounds and closed in a circle. I don't have that on here. I should get that. Yeah, this one. Yeah, I don't have that. I don't know if it's still there or not. I should dig into that some more. I've got a picture. This was an artist picture of mounds in North America, you know, on this big temple here. Looks like Solomon's temple to me. Looks like they've got a fire going, all these people going up to it, and this could be totally wrong, it could be right, we don't know. But if, you know, the Nephites were up here, this is what I would think it would look like. This to me looks like the Old Testament times, and they're going up here, walking up to this temple. I thought that was a really neat picture. I wanted to include it. I mean, nowadays you see these mounds scattered around the country, and they don't seem very significant. But when you think about it this way, what could have been built upon those mounds? Who were these people? Was there a big city there? It really kind of changes your perspective. This was a temple, what they believe to have been a temple that found in Tennessee. This was a photograph of the Hopewell Temple site on the Clinch River, East Tennessee. And this is what the Millennial Star said. It says, in 1934, the Tennessee Valley Authority was constructing a dam which would flood a portion of the Clinch River in East Tennessee. Because the area to be flooded included a Hopewell Native American mound, a group of archaeologists were called in to excavate the site. The archaeologists came upon an amazing discovery when they uncovered the ruins of a large stone and wood structure. So unlike any other find found at a Hopewell site, British Egyptologist James Rendell Harris from the London Museum was consulted. At the site, Harris identified the structure as an Egyptian temple. A single newspaper article documents this account. Another article, a temple in Tennessee, University of London, 1935. It says, the stone ruins of a large stone and wood structure uncovered beneath a Hopewell mound was made during excavation of the site that was about to be flooded by the building of the TVA Dam project. Rendell Harris placed heavy emphasis on an Egyptian presence in East Tennessee due to place names that were still in use by the local natives and the fact that Eastern Tennessee was rich in copper, also suggesting an Atlantic crossing. And then it says, the temple was erected on the Clinch River just below an Indian burial ground dating at 600 to 500 BC. You know, right around when the Lehi's family came here. So I don't know. We don't know if this is associated with the Book of Mormon people or not. Question, temple in Iowa. This was something that Wayne May presented that he's been involved with. If you look down there in the middle bottom, there's that green rectangle. It's kind of diagonal, cocked rectangularly. And then you can see a ridge or a bank on the bottom left of that. And then there's a bank on the top left. There's a bank on the bottom right along the trees. You can't see it because the trees cover up. And there's a bank on the north side. So this thing had banks that were built up around it and this rectangle in the middle. And this is right across from Nauvoo, Illinois. That's why he was looking at this. He was looking on Google Earth. You know, he must do that a lot, looking down on the earth, seeing if he sees anything. And he saw this. And so then he went to this place, he found out who owned this piece of property, and he talked to them, and they let him do a survey, and they bought it from the farmer that owned this, and they're getting ready to excavate it. Again, this is on the west side of Mississippi. Wayne May, he actually thinks this might be where Zarahemla was, and that's based on a revelation through Joseph Smith. I didn't put that in here. I have no idea. But they used radar and they looked into the ground to see if there's anything underneath this site here. And they found a structure that was 180 feet by 120 feet, starting at 5 feet below the ground, and it goes down to 22 feet. So, you know, how did it get buried like that? But there's a rectangular structure. And Solomon's temple was 90 by 60, so 180 by 120. It was the same ratio, not the same size, but the same ratio. And again, they purchased this and they're going to excavate it. And this just, these arrows point to the berms around this site. And then that yellow rectangle there in the middle, that's the structure that they found underneath the ground. Here's another view of the structure. Wooden structure, top of structure 5 to 7 feet deep, bottom of structure 22 feet. There's an account among people in the early church. Joseph Smith and some others encountered a mound, and they called it Zelph's Mound. In 1834, Joseph Smith wrote the following in the History of the Church, Volume 2, pages 79 through 80. During our travels, we visited several of the mounds which had been thrown up by the ancient inhabitants of this country, Nephites, Lamanites, etc. And this morning, I went up on a high mound near the river, accompanied by the brethren. On the top of the mound were stones which presented the appearance of three altars having been erected one above the other, according to the ancient order, and the remains of bones were strewn over the surface of the ground. The brethren procured a shovel and a hoe and removing the earth to the depth of about 1 foot, discovered the skeleton of a man almost entire, and between his ribs, the stone point of a Lamanitish arrow which evidently produced his death. And again, this is in Illinois. Elder Burr Riggs retained the arrow. The contemplation of the scenery around us produced peculiar sensations in our bosoms, and subsequently the visions of the past being opened to my understanding by the Spirit of the Almighty, I discovered that the person whose skeleton was before us was a white Lamanite, a large, thick-set man and a man of God. His name was Zelph. He was a warrior and chieftain under the great prophet Onondagas, who was known from the hill Cumorah, or Eastern Sea, to the Rocky Mountains. The curse taken from Zelph, or at least in part, one of his thigh bones was broken by a stone flung from a sling while in battle years before his death. He was killed in battle by the arrow found among his ribs during the last great struggle of the Lamanites and the Nephites. So I don't know if this, I don't know what, you know, Joseph Smith, he thought the Lord revealed this to him, and I don't know if that was the case or not, but I think it's worth considering. This man was of some importance if they built this mound around him. He died, must have been in war, and then they put him up, put the mound up around him. And so they called it Zelph's Mound. Here's a picture. Again, this is in Illinois. And this is a replica of the arrowhead. I don't know who has actual arrowhead now. I suppose maybe the LDS Church does. And this is just a replica. And then Wikipedia said, subsequent scientific investigation of the mound confirmed that the mound was a hopeful burial mound and dated to between 100 BC and 500 AD. Okay, heaped up bodies. This isn't very... I think I have one more quote I want to read here. No, I don't. Okay, this isn't very pleasant, but Alma 11:17-18, nevertheless, after many days, their dead bodies were heaped up upon the face of the earth, and they were covered with a shallow covering. And now so great was the scent thereof that the people did not go in to possess the land of Ammonihah for many years. You know, they had wars, and the bodies were heaped up because so many people died. This is a quote from Reverend Samuel Kirkland. He was a Presbyterian minister and a missionary among the Native Americans. It says, from many concurring accounts which I've been able to get from Indian historians of several tribes, there are well-defined traditions that long before the white man came, there was a great war in these parts, i.e. New York, that lasted many moons. An old gray-haired Indian told me that he and his progenitors before him had trampled over these hills and among these ruins, and that many ages of trees had grown up since the great battle took place. Some affirm that their old men had told them that thousands were slain and that the ground in and around the forts was covered with dead bodies. Those within the forts were thrown into hurriedly dug pits and covered with stone and earth to keep them from stinking, as they were besieged for a long time. Those killed on the outside of the forts were left to bleach upon the ground or be devoured by beasts. So, you know, this fits right in with what we read about in the Book of Mormon. Another quote, this is from a Seminole Indian chief. Serving as mission president in Central Florida, Brother Rawson had the responsibility of the work on the Seneca Indian Reservation. While there, he had numerous visits with the chief. While attempting to present the Book of Mormon, the chief interrupted his message by saying, "We had a war long ago with the light-skinned people around the Great Lakes. We conquered them, but we had so much respect for the warrior chief that we buried him at the mouth of the Oswego River, which is in New York State. We don't discuss this very much because it's an embarrassment to us." President Rawson asked, "Why is this an embarrassment?" "Our history is written on metal plates and buried in a hill in New York, but we don't know which hill." Supposedly it's a true story. I don't know for sure. This came from somebody in the LDS Church. If that's true, that's just a great story. Now I wanted to talk about white Indians. And I've only got a couple evidences of white Indians here in America. There are a lot more. This is the group that's called the Asgen. This was a map of the Ohio River Rapids, that this river is in the story I'm going to read. Chief Blackfish of the Shawnee quoted from Alan Eckert's The Frontiersman. Here, this is a story. It says, "The Shawnees," Blackfish said, he was the Indian chief, "cannot tell you that you are allowed to settle in the Kentucky lands. We have never owned that land. It belongs to the ghosts of those of murdered Azgins, a white people from an eastern sea. Their bones and ghosts own and occupy every hill and valley of the country. They protect the game there and have more and better right there than any of the Indian tribes, including our own Shawnee Nation, because they do not need or use material food themselves and do not like it. Long ago, our fathers and grandfathers killed off the Azgins, but we now fear more the spirits of these people than our fathers and grandfathers feared them when they were in the flesh." You know, so it was this white people group that was destroyed. Another quote, I know I'm doing a lot of reading here, but this is just powerful stuff. This is from Ancient American Magazine. It says, "Dr. J.P. Hale, president of the West Virginia Historical and Antiquarian Society, read an unusual 18-page report to its assembled members on January 19, 1897. Hale recalled native traditions handed down over many generations to the first European settlers in West Virginia. Among those who received the oral tradition firsthand was George Rogers Clark and two U.S. Army colonels who heard it repeated at Point Pleasant from Chief Cornstalk. He told of a race of white or light-skinned people originally from the East who dwelt in large numbers long ago in the Ohio Valley. Chased by warring red men, these ancient white people fled westward to the falls of the Ohio River near Louisville, Kentucky, where a bloody skirmish took place. Several hundred pale-faced survivors sought refuge on an island below the falls. With tomahawks raised and arrows aimed, the Indians attacked again. Not a single white person lived to tell the story." Got another one here. "History and Mystery of the Kanawha Valley" by J.P. Hale. This, I got something else I wanted to read here. So this is the title page of his paper, and he talks about this carved figure that they found in a cliff of a hill, or in a cave, I guess, and it's holding some sort of animal. What do you guys think that animal looks like? A lamb, maybe? Yeah, that's what they think. And this is from the report. It says, "The animal carried in the arms and against the breast probably had some important significance, possibly a peace offering intended for sacrifice. Opinions differ as to what the animal is intended to be represented. A lamb is at once suggested, but it may possibly have been a buffalo calf. It has a decidedly bovine head and the hump of the shoulders between the neck and the back is strongly suggestive of the lines of a buffalo's back." So maybe a buffalo. "When, by whom, and for what purpose this image was carved, and who secreted it in this almost inaccessible place, are impenetrable Kanawha mysteries." This is the Kanawha Valley. This is in West Virginia. It says, "Its appearance, as above stated, gives the impression of a very great age." He talks about the mound builders, numerous mounds, other stoneworks. "These people, although they are supposed to have attained a higher advance towards civilization than latter Indians, have left no evidence that they ever indulged in the character of work that produced this image. Then if neither the whites nor the Indians nor the mound builders called the image, by whom could it have been done?" That's his opinion. Let me read this. It says, "There was a tradition among the Indians of the Ohio Valley in the last century that in the long, long ago, how many moons they knew not, a race of white or light-colored people in large numbers coming originally from the east had dwelt in this valley and along the Ohio River, but had been gradually driven westward by their more warlike neighbors, their numbers being greatly diminished as they went, until in a pitched battle near the falls of the Ohio they were nearly exterminated. When the remnant of a few hundred took refuge on an island some distance below the falls, where their enemies followed up their advantage," it says that it killed them. "Found vast number of bones." Patty Ludingston, one of the early settlers here in the last century and who died not many years ago, said the Indians told him that this valley had long before been occupied by a white race. For want of a more plausible theory, this ill-fated and lost race of white or pale faces may also be credited with the possible authorship of an ancient, extensive, and unique stonework up the river some 20 miles above where this wooden image was found. If this valley was ever inhabited by an ill-fated race of pale faces, as tradition tells us, it is impossible that they may have brought with them from their ancient homes far away in time and distance traditions of their ancestral religions, beliefs, and rites. There is an impossible. And among them, the worship of a sacred ox, a sacred cow, calf, sacrificed lamb, or emblem of innocence and peace. Emblem of innocence and peace, so maybe a lamb. Another one, getting close to being done, I think, the Moon-Eyed People. This is at Fort Mountain State Park. And this is from Wikipedia. The state park derived its name from an ancient 885-foot long rock wall located on the peak. Talks about the zigzagging wall. The structure represents a prehistoric aboriginal construction whose precise age and nature cannot be safely hazarded until the whole problem of which this is representative has been more fully investigated. There are several legends concerning the wall. One legend claims that the wall is a remnant of one of the several stone forts legendary Welsh explorer Madoc and his group built throughout the present-day United States. This wall has also been related to the Moon-Eyed people of Cherokee lore. And this plaque, you guys can read it, it says, while some legends equate the Moon-Eyed people with the descendants of Prince Madoc, Cherokee legend tells of the Moon-Eyed people that inhabited the southern highlands before they arrived. These people are said to have been unable to see during certain phases of the moon. During one of these phases, the Creek people annihilated the rays. Some believe the Moon-Eyed people built the fortifications on the mountains. Other versions of the Cherokee legend tell us about people with fair skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes that occupied the mountain areas until Cherokee invaders finally dispersed them. Some tales said the Moon-Eyed people could see in the dark but were nearly blind in the daylight. Other legends describe them as albinos. So I don't know what this Moon-Eyed stuff is about, but, you know, a white race. Delaware Indian legend tells of their migration eastward from the far west and meeting a race of very tall, robust, light-skinned people they called the Alagui along the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. The Delaware were stopped in their advancement by the Alagui until they prevailed with the support of the Iroquois, who were also moving eastward. Some surviving Iroquois went to Cherokee territory and stayed with them for a time and are remembered in Tavinicula. Moon-Eyed people who were tall, fair-skinned, with light hair and gray eyes and carried strange weapons and tools. So this is right in a, you know, a public park or this fort. They acknowledge this white-skinned race. Fort Mountain, I think it's Georgia. It says Georgia here. Yeah, it's Georgia. Yeah, Georgia State Parks. Yep. They've named this Red Skies Migration Chart. It's a chart of a journey of some Native American peoples. It says here, according to Algonquin tradition, their ancestors long ago crossed the Great Water, the Atlantic Ocean. They came from the land of the rising sun. Their boats entered the St. Lawrence Channel and landed on the shores of Turtle Island, North America, in the vicinity of the Great Lakes. In Red Sky's migration chart above, notice the channel on the east and the representation of the Atlantic Ocean. So it's annotated down there at the bottom. I think those turtles, four turtles or boats, possibly. It says Atlantic Ocean. And then they made it into the St. Lawrence Passage there. Yeah, I'm not familiar with Turtle Island. Mackinac Island is Turtle Island? Okay. So they think that that was the ocean. They went through the channel or the St. Lawrence River. Then they got Lake Superior there in the middle, Whitefish Point.
Yep, that's Mackinac.
Okay. Yeah, Mackinac Island right there. Yep. Okay. And this says, this is from Historical Atlas, Wisconsin's past and present. A traditional migration chart was etched on a birch bark scroll owned by Mitiawan leader James Red Sky. In 1960, he recounted the legend of the Ojibwe journey from the Atlantic Ocean to Minnesota. The modern map shows a historic migration route and the domain of the Ojibwe established. The chart tracing shows not only physical features the Ojibwe saw during the centuries-long migration, but also the deeper spiritual meaning of the journey in the landscape. This is a Mi'kmaq prayer group. There was a Native American group called the Mi'kmaq. They occupied parts of Canada, is what it says here, and they used a hieroglyphic writing. So consider that, and then consider this, the Anton transcript. And these were characters copied from the Book of Mormon plates. And what's interesting about this that I never thought about before, but something that other people picked up on, if you look at the top left, the letters or the hieroglyph starts out real big. And the farther you get into this, they get smaller and smaller and smaller, almost like there was a complete story here. And they didn't, you know, when they inscribed this, Joseph Smith or whoever this was, did not want to leave out any part of the story, maybe, I don't know. So that's one theory as to why these letters get smaller and smaller and smaller. So then they've done a comparison of some of the Mi'kmaq writing with some of the Book of Anton transcript characters, and a lot of them, you know, line right up. I didn't personally go through and check this myself, but I suppose if you had the time, you could verify this. Yeah, they're not exactly the same. But I mean, yeah, the language could have changed over time. They could have, who knows. Mm-hmm. I mean, these could be people that were not the core group that we read about in the Book of Mormon. I mean, I guess they did migrate. Well, this is the Mi'kmaq, so they maybe they weren't the core group, and maybe they were descendants of them. What's that? Right, yeah, they could be other lost tribes. This one's really neat. Okay, I'm going to try to hurry up here. This one's Ohio Decalogue Stone. This has got Hebrew writing on it. This was found in Ohio at the Great Stone Stack Ruin. Small limestone box, about a foot length and perhaps 8 inches wide. It contained the Ten Commandments, known as monumental Hebrew writing. It's another one, Newark, Ohio Keystone. This has Hebrew writing on it. One side says Holy of Holies, the other one says the Law of Yahweh, another side King of the Earth, and the other one the Word of Yahweh. This Lost Lunas Decalogue Stone, this is in New Mexico that people believe, or a bridge version of the Decalogue or Ten Commandments. And they don't really take care of the site. I don't even know if it's even fenced in. You know, people can go in here and graffiti this rock because they don't take it seriously. This is the Bat Creek Stone. This was found in Tennessee. There was a man that translated this, Dr. Cyrus Gordon, and he translated it as for Judah. It says, inscription is a Hebrew language, an old Hebrew script of around AD 100. Grave Creek Stone, this was near Grave Creek Mound in West Virginia. Some scholars believe some characters are of Hebrew origin. This is another one. Probably doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with the Book of Mormon, but it's called Dighton Rock. It's a boulder that was in the riverbed that was covered up And they moved it, but it's got these strange characters and inscriptions on it. Burroughs Cave, there was a cave that a man named Russell Burroughs claimed to have found in southern Illinois. He said it was filled with Black River stones, white marble coins, and engraved sandstone and gold artifacts. And a lot of the artifacts have Christian themes. A lot, you know, mainstream archaeologists, a lot of them think that it is a fraud or a hoax. And there is some evidence of that because I guess there was some person that was creating fake artifacts about the same time these all came to light. So I don't know. I don't know if these are, you know, real or not, or authentic. And this was a hieroglyphic Egyptian ruler. This is a king of Egypt. I think I read somewhere that some thought this was Joseph in the Bible. This is information regarding King Solomon. That one, you know, I don't. That one looks pretty authentic to me. When you look at some of these other ones, you won't think that. This was supposedly King Solomon's first wife. Map of the Hio River, now called the Mississippi. This is Egyptian gold coin. King Solomon with the menorah above his head. Now these kind of look more cartoony, like somebody maybe, you know, did these themselves in modern day, but I don't know. This was supposed to be Jesus. You know, there's different things on this rock. Son of the right hand and other things. This is another one. Crucifixion, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Here's another one here. Jesus Christ with the disciples. And then a lot of them have this, what they call the mystic symbol, which I believe they think is representative of Yahweh, maybe, or it might be Jehovah. And of course, we've got the evidence of Hill Cumorah, you know, where Joseph Smith went and got the plates. So there are people that think there were two Hill Cumorahs, one in Central America and one in North America, and that Moroni, you know, the Book of Mormon took place in Central America, and then after that, Moroni came all the way up to New York and put the plates under the rock where Joseph Smith found them, which might be the case, or it might not be. If this is the original Hill Cumorah in the Book of Mormon, you know, it's in New York. It would line right up with these Indian groups we find in the United States, but I don't know. But it's, you know, definitely something to consider. Two more slides here. You know, this is a map. It shows some of the Book of Mormon taking place down here in Central America, above South America, Lehi's Landing, City of Nephi. You come up here, Waters of Mormon, you know, down here in Mexico. You get up in the United States. And then they've got Zarahemla, Bountiful, et cetera, et cetera. And then they've got land desolation up here in the north. To me, you know, I like this idea of having these different places in this continental United States, like Moroni told Joseph Smith, the continent, the former inhabitants of this continent. You know, maybe it was something like this. You know, maybe it was spread all over this land. And then my last slide, I just a tidbit. Yesterday I found this. These red lines are ruins that they found out here in the Caribbean Sea. So, you know, in the Book of Mormon, it talks about how the geography was changed when Christ was crucified and how cities were sunk. So you wonder, you know, where did they live out here in the Caribbean? Was this land raised up? But when Christ was crucified, it all sank into the earth. And based on these ruins they found, that must be the case. So, you know, how much has the geography of North America and Central America, how much of it has changed due to the crucifixion catastrophe? Was it so significant that major land masses and areas were sunk into the water so we can't line up the Book of Mormon geography 100% with what we now see geography-wise. So that's it. I think that was really exciting. I really like presenting that. It's really neat. If you want to learn more about this or if you want to learn more about the idea of some of the Book of Mormon story, if not all, taking place in the United States, there's some really good books by Wayne May, and they're called This Land. There's like five of them. So that's all I have. Well, I think it's really, really neat stuff. Really neat stuff.